Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to the sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with the history of the sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on Mushing.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert, and I am sitting here with my co-host, Karosh Parto, and we're going to turn the tables a little bit, and I'm going to interview him. He has been a guest on our podcast a few times. We have done a feature article with him in Mushing Magazine, and he was a feature article interview in a previous issue of Mushing Magazine several years ago before we took it over. Karosh, welcome back to the show. What's happening?
Well, I guess if you've been around for so many years, you get many interviews, right? So everything is okay. You mentioned Mushing Magazine and interviews and everything. I think I've been Mushing Magazine like two or three times for Super Dogs, and before actually you purchased it, I think, well, back when Greg Salentin, I think, and even before him, someone had it. But been around for 40 years, so I'm sure I've done a few interviews. So nothing, just getting used to this crazy weather we have. Training has been good, okay, was good, but we've been shut down for a little bit because of snow conditions this year again. Last year was bad, but this year is worse, actually. Believe it or not, I was looking at my training logs last year, and this is by far, probably in 26 years of being in Alaska, the worst training conditions we had. And we can't even go up north, right, because it's super, super cold up there.
And for folks that are listening, obviously, we've kicked off the podcast again. KP and I are going to be hosting that with a lot of really cool interviews. Focusing on some dry land folks coming up, but I know, KP, you've done a little bit of dry land in your day. You've done some Siberian racing that we've talked about before. You've gone over to the dark side, as they say, from the Siberians to the other, and done a lot of races in your day, including the Fur Rondi and other races. I want to ask you a couple of questions, sort of a highlight reel, if you will, about your racing career. Do a little bit of a breaking news here towards the end of the show. I guess the first start of this is, what is your favorite race that you've raced in all time in 40 plus years?
As you said, I started racing in 87 in Europe with Siberian Huskies. I've done all continental Europe races, Scandinavia, and then we moved to the United States, Midwest, in Wisconsin, and then I did the circuit, of course, in Midwest, and then the Colorado circuit on the West Coast, and then the Canada circuit, and then we decided to move to Alaska and do the Mecca, what I call, of the sled dog racing, in my opinion, circuit. You know, and I've done it quite, like you said, I've done it all. I've done it canicross, bike touring, scooter, kart racing, 4, 6, 8, 10, open, and even mid-distance. And last 2 years ago, and actually I borrowed a dog team and I did a long-distance race, a 90-miler with
the solo sweepstake?
The solo sweepstake. Yes. I've done my first, I guess mid-distance, not long-distance race with dogs I borrowed from Sean Williams, who just came back from Iditarod. But to be honest, my favorite race is my race, is Eagle River Classic, you know, Chugiak Dog Mushers Dog Trails. Trails are up and down, left and right, windy, technical. You have to be on your toes. If you don't pay attention, you hurt a dog. Or you crash, burn, you know, passes are always critical. And I've done this race in 4-dog class, 6-dog class, 8-dog class, 10-dog class, and actually not 10-dog because it didn't happen, and open class, of course.
So the Eagle River Classic, and as you're talking about these, Karosh, I've been racing for about 30 years. I started in northern Minnesota. And as you're talking, I wonder how many times you and I have crossed paths, because I've done quite a bit of racing and sprint racing before, just to dabble. I've never been very good. But it's interesting to see if we've ever crossed paths in racing. But you and I have known each other for 10, 15 years now here in Alaska.
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, we used to have a house very close to yours, right? In Willow, that was our kind of a sled dog camp. And me and my previous kennel partner, Ken Chizik, we owned that place and we used to go train there. And yeah, I know you for at least, I think, 15 years or so, right about that.
Yep. So we asked about your favorite race in the world. What has, and don't say, you cannot say Eagle River Classic.
Okay.
What is your most challenging race? And maybe it's to get there, to even get to this race, whether it be training conditions or distance or trail itself. Most challenging race.
That I've done?
Yep.
Most challenging race that I've done was a three-dog Siberian in Spain in mid-distance. And it was the most grueling race that I've done in my life. It was going up. It seemed like it was going up the mountain the whole time, honest. It was horrific. Plus, as you know, the Siberians, they are not the fastest. But I guess I don't want to piss off any Siberian drivers, but they're not, you know. But it was hot. It was maybe 50 degrees, high altitude in the Pyrenees in Spain. And you just go up the mountain. And I thought it was, I want to say it was like 20 miles, some crazy distance.
For a three-dog race?
Oh, yeah. It was horrible. Whoa. It was horrible. It was back, they called it the C1 class. We didn't have the four-dog class yet. It was C1. And it was far away from Paris where we lived. It took like a day and a half to get there, and then in the mountains, snow conditions that were bad, and it was sorry.
It was rough. So the next question is, racing around the world, sometimes we don't take time to look around because we're all focused in what we're doing. Where's the most beautiful place you have ever raced? Is it here in Alaska? Is it, like you said, in the Pyrenees? Is it in Northern Europe? Where is the most beautiful place you've ever ran?
You know, in Alaska, as you know, because you live here, our landscape is pretty phenomenal, right? And a lot of our races, as you know, they're in swamplands usually because those are, you know, tundra that you get. And you don't have a lot of views or anything exotic on it. In Chugiak, you're in the woods the whole time. All you see is, you know, spruce trees. But there are some sections you get and you see the inlet. You're right by the ocean, I guess. You see the water and all of that. Those are pretty cool views. Montana Creek has actually a fairly nice trail system. It's pretty beautiful. You know, you are in the swamps, but you see Denali. And once in a while, when the sun is right, the lights are right, you see Hunter, Foraker, Denali, those gigantic mountains right in your face as you're coming with a, you know, big dog team looking at them. Those are pretty spectacular views, I would say.
Next up is most unique race experience you've had. You ran in Rondi, you've ran in some big time open class races, of course, over in Europe, in lower 48. What is the most unique format? Is it something like Rondi?
Probably Rondi, actually. That's pretty unique. And I would say last year's Rondi was even crazier, right? Because it was a drag race, right? Going out the street for just a short miles. And it was pretty exhilarating because there is no planning. You just go all out. And you just go into full speed that you can go. I was going 24 miles an hour.
And that was only three or four miles?
Oh, it was like 4 miles or so. It was, yeah, I don't think it was five, actually. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. People liked it, you know. People liked it. People that were screaming, hollering and everything because, you know, it's right. And people that don't care if we are going 25 miles or 4 miles, as long as the show is on in the streets, they don't see what we are doing in the woods, right? Just waiting for us to come back. And the avenue is obviously the spectacular part of the Rondi. That's where people are hollering and cowbells and all kind of crazy stuff going on.
Welcome to the Mushing Podcast. It's time for another memorable moment in mushing history. Sponsored by Peak Experience, providing experiential and team-building courses.
In October 1977, the Montana Creek Dog Mushers launched their first safari trip on the 12th of November. Ron Aldridge led out five other stalwart long-distance mushers on a 30-mile round trip through mostly unbroken trail through the wilderness. 15 miles out, the drivers stopped for a lunch break and sat around telling lies and talking dogs. Those making the trip were Ralph Lee, the 1975 Iditarod finisher, Fred Atkins, Iditarod hopeful, his two sons, Mel and Steve, both with the Iditarod on their minds, and the biggest of the lot, Tuffy Rybeski, and his double-track Alpine. While having lunch, Marge Moore caught up with the group, driving 12 dogs and carrying a passenger, Andy Vogel. Marge hopes to make the Nome trip in 1979 and would do this year, except she doesn't have a sponsor. While the safari wasn't considered a fantastic success, the Montana mushers feel that it was moderately successful and will be better received on the 26th of November. Poor snow conditions and a last-minute change in route and departure point affected the turnout. 31 Chichaco dog mushers, drivers who had never raced in any race sponsored by a recognized race-giving organization, competed in the three-mile, three-dog team race sponsored by the Montana Creek Mushers on October 6, 1977. The trail was made on flat tundra with a hard-packed 2-inch snow surface and was rough. Temps were in the 10s degrees range and skies were clear.
Speaking of the Avenue, I was just down there the other day for the lighting ceremony of the brand new arch.
Oh, yeah.
Man, have you seen it in person?
Yes.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It's very cool. And I heard you have, you're a sponsor, I heard.
A very small sponsor.
Yes.
I know people sponsored the dogs, and they were like $10,000 for a dog. But yeah, very small sponsor as Mushing Magazine. So we're going to continue on this favorite part of the sport, or a story or two. Driving around all these races in all of these years, what is that like? I'm sure you've had a lot of different setups over the years. I know you have a dog truck now. Can you give us an experience or two about what it's like to travel to some of these races?
Yeah, definitely. You know, over the years, over the decades of racing, things, they changed. And we talk about it all the time. The sport changed. So I guess the rigs and the trucks and the cars, they changed too. When we started in France, we were super poor. We were super, extremely poor. We could barely afford a car. So what we had a Ford Escort. When we had rigs and originally we had like scooters and everything. You just shoved the dogs and the scooter, everything inside the Ford Escort. It was me and Diana would or sleep in the car or whatever, and or come back home, I guess. We would travel with this. When then we had the rig, we had up to, God, I don't know, like 3, 4, 5 dogs in the Escort. And I would take the front tire of the rig off and shove the rig because we were too poor to buy a trailer. So we would shove the rig into the Ford Escort also and just go to races. And then we did a little bit better. So we got a loan and we bought a Ford Transit, like a van, which we have right now in Europe, in the U.S. You see quite a bit of those. And that was like, oh, my God, that was like big. Big money for us. So we bought a Ford Transit, and inside of it, I had a lot of cages. I had up to, I think I had up to 12 dogs, and it was like a camping car set up. And then we sold everything and moved to the United States. And here we had another van, kind of like in the European setup, because that was all we knew. We didn't have dog trucks. In Europe, dog trucks are extremely expensive. I'm talking about pickup trucks with boxes on them. So we had another van here, like a Chevy or Ford or something like that. And then we got into the dog truck. We got a little bit of money and we bought pickup trucks with those Chatmack boxes, which Doug...
That was top of the line back then.
Yeah, they are still, honestly, top of the line. They are FRP fiberglass boxes. They are very, very cool. We had those and never had a trailer. Never had a trailer. I thought dog trucks, they were easier and safer for the crew. And we have a dog truck right now. We can haul up to 28 dogs. Not that I ever had 28 dogs, but we can haul quite a bit.
Yeah, it has changed quite a bit. I've always been a dog truck guy. You know about my sled dog, Jeep.
Jeep?
Yep. I think it's the only one in the world that's like that. It's pretty sweet. But I like how things have changed over the years. So let's talk a little bit about your dogs over the years. You said you started with Siberians. I think if I remember correctly, they were living with you in your apartment in Paris.
God, yeah, that madness, definitely madness. We had up to 8 dogs. We lived down in town, in Paris, actually. We had up to 8 dogs in the studio, Diana and myself, in Paris, on the fourth floor of this 100-year-old apartment, and no elevator, of course. And it was a full-time job to take care of them, because you had to take them up and down just to let them go pee and do their business. And it was definitely chaotic. And the place was so small that we had to actually build like a mezzanine, like a bed for us to be able to sleep on top, and the dogs there on the bottom, 8 of those guys.
A bunk bed.
Oh yeah, it was a bunk bed. Yeah, we slept on top. And then when we decided to move to, so those are all Siberian Huskies and different bloodlines, of course. And then we decided to move to the United States, and we started in Wisconsin. Very, very first dog we had was from a few of the Midwesterners, Mike Marsh. That we mentioned his name in the previous last set of interviews, and he's been still doing that. And of course, the Munford Lions, they were all Alaskans. Ken and Lori Chizik, they had those. We had Alaskans up to, I believe, late 80s, and then that's when Egalilis and Eurohounds, they came to Alaska, and we changed our format. We acquired quite a bit of dogs. I went to Norway and I picked up, I believe, 9 dogs or so from different lines. From Asbjørn Erdal Aas, Jan Svensson, Thomas Wernerberg, Utenaas, they were all the, you know, Eurohounds up back then, and we created our own lines here. And then a few years ago, we decided to introduce some Saluki, Desert Saluki hound in the lines. So we had a few of those. Some of them were made the team, open team. And for the last few years, we've been having basically our own lines mixed with our friend Mari Rado, and everybody you see in the yard right now, they're all from them. I have 15 dogs, all males currently.
All males. And I think people listening will be intrigued by this, but that is deliberate.
Yes.
To have the all males. Explain that decision.
Yes, I don't consider myself a breeder per se. I usually have my friends or people that I partner with do litters. In 40 years of racing, I've done, I believe, 3 litters. Like the one I whelped, actually. So the reason I have males is no heats, no, you know, no accidental breedings, no crazy stuff. And our kennel setup is, as you can see, it is very compact. We have, as I said, we have 15 dogs right now. The kennel can handle up to 20 dogs. I think the most I ever owned in my life was 19 at the same time. And so it's deliberate. Yeah, I keep the males, and it works out for us. And we've been doing that for many, many years.
For perspective, when people think of Alaska, they think wild frontier, middle of nowhere. But you are just on the outskirts of Anchorage. What are you, about 15 miles-ish or so? Kind of in a neighborhood, suburb, I guess you would be. Why here compared to other places? You talked about your camp in Willow, where I live. Why
yes.
Here now?
First of all, we have both myself and my wife. We have professional lives, so we go to work every day, and 8-to-5 jobs. And 8-to-5 jobs are usually in big cities. And we picked this place in Chugiak. Is 20 some years ago, Chugiak had many, many, many dog teams. It was like we had 30, 40 kennels around us, and it was fairly normal to find a 2.5-acre parcel where you can have a small kennel or even big kennel and a dog track, which is a mile away. You can go and train. Throughout the years, I guess this number got reduced more and more and more. And people like myself, I'm a builder, land developer. We bought these big chunks of land and chopped them. And instead of 2.5 acres, we had 2-acre lots, right? And so those bigger parcels, they went away. And right now it's extremely difficult to find a chunk of land close enough to Anchorage where you can go to work and also big enough to have a neighbor and not having difficulties. Even me being surrounded, two sides of our place is wooded. I still have neighbors I have to very, very closely watch. Dogs not bark or going crazy, and it's, otherwise you get complaints.
You spoke about mini kennels here in Chugiak. This has a lot of mushing history. Your sign for your city has a dog team on it as you're pulling into this area. There's just a couple of you guys left now. How many do you think? Do you know right off the top?
We open drivers, that's it.
Just you?
That's it. Yeah. Open driver in the municipality of Anchorage, it is me. That's it. As a matter of fact, I believe even anything in a 10-dog or so, we don't have anymore. Back, like you said, in Chugiak, we had like, there was not one day you go outside, you cannot hear dogs barking from half a mile away, quarter mile away, howling or seeing dog trucks go back and forth. It was the place. It was, if you had, job in Anchorage, you lived in Chugiak and you kept your dog kennel here. And, oh God.
Half a dozen maybe left?
Oh, right now, probably half a dozen.
Yeah, because I know Lanier is still in this area,
yep.
A couple other smaller teams, but nothing like before.
No, nothing like before.
Yep. So let's talk about a little bit about a news update. When we last did this podcast several years ago, you were in the thick of it. You were doing Rondi every year in the open and all sorts of stuff. Doing racing big time, and of course,
yes.
Lots has changed. But we were talking today, and you said this year might be the last year. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it may be. I'm trying to convince myself. I've been racing very seriously for 40 years now, and I've done it all. I lost many, many races. I think last time I counted, I've won over 400 races over the years, and I lost probably way more. But you get to a point that you have to make decisions, and you have to, and for us, it's a lifestyle. We talked about that. It wasn't a jaunt. You have people coming in, getting 8 dogs right away and race for 5-10 years or for family reason, health reason, work reasons. We organize, and you the same, around the dogs. You pick a job where you can race dogs or do dogs, or you buy a house where you can raise dogs or have dogs, or you take your vacation based on your training schedule. So I am getting to a certain point of life that, I want to see a little bit different things. I'll be still involved potentially. You cannot just let it go, right? You've been doing it for decades, and all your friends are sled dog people. A couple years ago, my kennel partners, they decided to do the same after, for them, it was even longer. Ken Cheezik, after, many years, he decided that it was time to, hang up the harnesses and just come outside and watch the sport from outside. They are still very involved. And I think for us, it's going to be probably the year, it's the 40th year, and I put this targeted year in my head, and we have a very, very competitive dog team, and in order to be good and do well, you have to be fully vested, and you cannot do half-ass. You have to do it all or nothing, and for me, I've been doing it over the years, and I don't want to be going to a race just to participate. I want to go to be a contender, and so if it's retiring, I prefer retiring completely and call it good and see my dogs in other teams and say, this is Chopper, my leader, who is winning in such and such team right now. So there is a good chance this is going to be the last hurrah for us.
Speaking of all in and lifestyle and all that, it's funny you brought that up because my wife, Michelle, and I, we've been doing this together for well over 25 years. And we were just talking the other night, we were talking about how much we've had invested in this. And we came up to well over $1 million in all of these years in just dog food alone, in all these years, right?
Probably. I don't want to know.
But if you think about that, Karosh, just on a monetary perspective, 40 years, 30 years for myself. Just imagine how much time, money, effort we've put into this.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. I usually don't want to count.
Yeah.
Because if you start to count like the pallets of dog food or the pallets of meat or the cost of fuel, I was telling one of my friends last year when we had crappy conditions, we would travel 2 hours to Hatcher Pass from here to get ATV runs on the dogs and come back, it was $50 each training, just for fuel. I'm not talking about the rest of it. And we did that many times to be able to keep the mileage going on the guys. And it was just crazy. So when you talk about money and the time and this blood and sweat and all of that, it takes a lot. The guys who are doing well in the sport, it's not by accident. And people who are staying it long time, they, you know, hats off, because it's not a cheap sport. And that's part of the reason you see less and less people.
Yep. And I think that's one of the reasons why things are changing. And it's not just climate. It's financial. It's time. It's work. It's all of that. And we're going to cover a lot of that on this podcast. That's one of the reasons why we brought this back, because
yes,
there are a lot of stories that you and I can share.
Absolutely.
That nobody else is talking about. Right. There is one other Mushing podcast, and they interview folk about racing. So it's interesting to talk to somebody about other things than mushing, for sure. So, KP, we always ask the same questions on our show. I'm interested to hear what you have to say. First up is music. What are you listening to? What's your favorite song and or artist?
What do I listen to? I Spotify and in my truck when I'm driving around. Usually it's country music, and it's not the old school traditional, not the new ones. I listen to Chris Stapleton quite a bit.
My wife loves Chris Stapleton.
Yeah, he's my guy. I listen, I have all his albums and everything on my favorites.
Do you have a favorite song by him by chance?
White Horse.
White Horse. Okay, I will write that down for sure. Okay, next one is, I know you're kind of a techie gear guy. You have some cool stuff laying around. I know we always talk about stuff like that. What do you always have with you other than your phone, whether it's on a road trip or on a training run? What do you always carry?
If it's with dogs, usually GPSs. I do a lot of pacing, a lot of watching stats on the dogs and controlling their speed. So probably GPS. On my ATVs, actually, I have GPSs too, so I use that to know exactly what we are pacing and what we are.
Speaking of GPS, I know that you're a Garmin watch fan. I'm looking at it right now. What are you wearing? What is that watch you have?
It's an older one. It's a Fenix 7 Pro.
I have had one of those before. We're going to link that in the show notes for sure.
Here we go.
Next up is... you've been all around the world with your dogs. I'm sure you've stopped at a lot of places. When we talked about on a previous episode, I said I was over in South Korea and going to the ramen library. What is your go-to road trip snack? If you're pulling off the side of the road, what are you picking up?
God, for food. You know, we, as I said, it's actually, you will know exactly the spot. With the dogs, we go a lot to Willow, and which that's where you live. And Willow is... every time we go to Willow, there used to be holidays there. And when our son Alex, he was younger, he called that place Halfway Holiday, because it was halfway between Willow and our house here.
Okay.
And we always stopped there and we got a hot dog.
Okay.
So Halfway Holiday hot dog.
You know, we're going to talk to another guest. We've already recorded, so we're time traveling a little bit. But he said that he picks up gas station egg rolls. And I've always said, never eat the gas station sushi. You eat the hot dogs.
I do the halfway holiday hot dog.
All right, guys. Karosh, I'm glad we're back here. For folks that may not know who you are, where are you active on social?
It is mainly on Facebook, and that's about it. I have Instagram, but I don't.
Old school. Old school. I hate Instagram, but I do it because of the business. All right. Thanks you for being on the show. Definitely hit that subscribe button. We have a lot of cool episodes coming up, including about hunting sled dogs that hunt bears, and a world-class motocross racer who has shifted over to world-class sled dog racer. We've got it all coming up.
Yep. It'll be fun.
It will be fun. So stick around, and we'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.